dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. China, of course, is at the center of the war for the free world these days, and few people understand that better than our first guest. He is the chairman of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, a wonderful pickup team that I'm proud to serve as the vice chairman of. And he has brought to this particular portfolio a wealth of experience as president and a long-term senior vice president of the Claremont Institute. And he is now the president and founder of the American Strategy Group. His name is Brian Kennedy, a friend and colleague we're delighted to have with us. Brian, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Well, I wanted to talk to you a bit about a major focus of effort of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, that you've been leading on. Talk to us a little bit about this Thrift Savings Plan initiative that would invest the retirement funds of American servicemen and women and other federal employees in some rather problematic Chinese communist companies, among others.
Yes, no, I think it's probably the most important issue American policymakers should be looking at today. Can you imagine that millions of retirees, including many in the military, current people serving in the military as well, are going to have a portion of their retirement funds invested in communist China? I would say, especially now during this coronavirus crisis, which we know emanated from China and which has caused an enormous amount of damage to our economy and to human life and what have you. The idea that during all this, we're going to be investing money in communist China, in effect, investing in their success and the success of individual companies, many of whom are either involved in the persecution and imprisonment of the Uyghurs population in China, or are building weapons of mass destruction and other military equipment to be used against their main enemy, the United States. The idea we would invest in that looks to most Americans simply outrageous, confusing. How can this be happening? Obscene, but I mean, suicidal, I think would be another way of thinking about it.
But especially, as you say, Brian, the uniformed service personnel of our country having to help the companies that are building weapons to kill them is nothing less than obscene, it seems to me. So this, as a result of the committee's efforts, I think it's fair to say, we've seen this issue now get to the President of the United States. There are reports that he's taken a position on it rather forthrightly. Where do things stand, as you understand it, inside the Trump administration at the moment?
Well, the president can appoint people to varying terms on the board of the Thrift Savings Plan, and he has done that. He's nominated three people whose terms had expired, and those people, one hopes, are about to join the board in the next, you know, days, weeks, months, whenever the U.S. Senate can confirm them, and that they will move forthwith to make sure that this doesn't happen. And so the president has taken, as you might expect, some very bold action to make sure that American retirees were not having this money invested there. That's all to the good. But, you know, the way Washington works, and you know that better than nearly anyone I know, there's all sorts of roadblocks. These people have to be confirmed. They have to be confirmed in a timely manner. The money can't be invested while they're still in this sort of administrative limbo. And the president should be thanked for that kind of leadership, especially while he's in the middle of trying to deal with this coronavirus crisis. But shame on anyone within this system, whether it's the Thrift Savings Plan or the National Economic Council or the Treasury Department, or wherever, that was not more on top of this to begin with. how is it possible that parts of this government, a government dedicated to taking on and holding China to account for all their malfeasance, could not have this, you know, could not preemptively have done this, that private citizens like you and me, even operating, you know, as we do, the idea that we had to organize ourselves and organize we did to try to explain to a large number of policymakers what was going on. The fact that we had to do that and there weren't people in the government making sure this didn't happen, I think is something that is also an outrage.
Brian, before we run out of time, I wanted quickly to ask you about a related matter, which is the role that the Securities and Exchange Commission plays in all of this. They seem to have been, well, giving the Chinese Communist Party-associated companies on our stock exchange a pass when it comes to fulfilling the requirements that our statutes establish and accounting practices and regulations and the like for transparency, accountability, governance and due diligence. There's an interesting op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today by former chairman of the SEC, Arthur Levitt, and one of his senior subordinates, Michael Mann, called the SEC's China Evasion, which takes the chairman, Jay Clayton, and others to task for sort of professing some concern about all of this, but not doing anything about it. Your thoughts?
I thought that was an excellent piece, and I'd recommend it. What we're seeing here is that the SEC doesn't believe it has any role whatsoever to protect American investors when it comes to China. They will regulate American industries in a very heavy-handed way whenever they want to. They will require, quite justifiably, all sorts of transparency and disclosures and audits and public accounting standards so that American corporations abide by certain rules and American investors can know that when they buy a stock, it is being scrutinized by other outside eyes and that the corporation is simply not lying. When it comes to China, however, they give them an entire pass with regards to all this. The Chinese say that all of our internal documents of all these companies are state secrets and you're not going to get them. And the SEC, instead of challenging that, and requiring for them to come to U.S. capital markets that they actually comply with our PCAOB, the public accounting standards. Instead of doing the thing that every American corporation has to do, they give them a complete pass, meaning these Chinese corporations are not required to have any of the disclosure of what's going on. Arthur Levitt, as you say, the former chairman and others, have been saying, how is this fair? How is this fair? How is this fair to American companies? Number one. Number two, how is the SEC even conceivably making an argument that they're protecting American investors? And in fact, I think it's becoming ever more clear the SEC has no interest in protecting American investors. And they're letting China come in very large, you know, numbers.
This is a failure to live up to their responsibilities, and I believe that the chairman, Jay Clayton, has to be held accountable. My own feeling about it is that this is a good time for him to go. This is a subject to which we will return, I hope, with you very soon. Brian Kennedy, again, thank you for your leadership of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and your lifetime of service, really, to the public policy debate and decision-making of our country for decades. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us very soon. Next up, we will speak with Ambassador Henry Cooper about the new presidential executive order on protecting our grid and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by a friend and colleague of many years. His name is Ambassador Henry Cooper. He has served his country in a whole host of capacities, always with distinction, and I think to the great benefit of the American people and their security. Initially as a uniformed officer of the United States Air Force, then a civilian in the Air Force Department. Then he went on to become, among other things, an assistant director of the unlamented late Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. He was a negotiator for President Reagan on defense and space matters and served as the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization under President George H.W. Bush. A man of many parts who these days is the driving force still behind a marvelous organization created by Lieutenant General Danny Graham called High Frontier. Ambassador Cooper, it's good to have you back, sir. Always a pleasure to have you in the House. I was very interested to see in your High Frontier newsletter, Hank, online now at highfrontier.org. An appraisal of something we've been talking about with a number of guests in recent days, namely this new executive order that President Trump issued about the need to eliminate, I think is basically the idea, our reliance on foreign suppliers, particularly malevolent ones like China, in our electric grid. You've spent a lot of time working on and worrying about the grid. You described this as a bit of a mixed bag, this executive order. Tell us why.
I think the executive order is an important step and dealing with the threat, especially from China, but not solely from China, other nations who choose to go after one of our most vulnerable infrastructures, the electric power grid, upon which practically every other industry or a way of life in our country depends, is a really important step that the president is taking. So the mixed bag is that that's the good news. And a lot of detail you can get by checking my last message on why I believe that's so. The reason I say mixed bag is that it deals only with what is defined as the bulk power grid, which consists of our generation plants and the transmission lines that carry high voltage electricity down to a step-down transformer that converts to a lower voltage and makes it useful to the citizens and industry and our vital assets within the nation. All of them actually depend on it. That's called the distribution grid. And the dividing line that was chosen is at 70 kilovolts, 70,000 volts. Where you go into these humongous step-down transformers that convert the electricity to lower voltage where it's useful. What's left out almost entirely by this executive order is the distribution grid, which constitutes 90% of the grid overall and 70% of the cost of the transmission and distribution lines in the nation. So leaving out a major portion of the grid upon which the private citizens and depend for their not only their livelihood, but also their very existence.
To finish up the thought on the executive order, what you basically are saying, if I understand you correctly, is it's good as far as it goes. It's just that it doesn't cover the full character and capabilities and dimensions of the grid. And therefore, to the extent that we have vulnerabilities arising from having foreign companies or entities supplying equipment to that 70% of the grid that is not covered by this executive order, that vulnerability would remain. Is that essentially the gist of your concern?
Yes, it's 90% of the grid, however, not 70. 70% of the cost of just the transmission and distribution lines that deliver the electricity.
So the generating part of the grid is a relatively small part. It's vitally important, obviously. If you don't have those generators, you don't have anything to distribute. But what is your surmise, Ambassador Cooper, as to why this executive order would leave out such a very substantial part of the problematic, vulnerable grid that we are dependent upon?
I don't have a good answer for that. I think it was a serious omission. I applaud the president for taking the step he did. He can fix it with another stroke of his pen just by making sure the whole grid is included. The only place it's even mentioned with a directive is as a problem area whereby, of course, it's vulnerable to the cyber threats as well. And if you if an enemy were to attack the distribution grid in an appropriate way, then it could also lead to a threat to the bulk power grid. And that's certainly true. But leaving it out entirely leaves out a major portion of the grid upon which the viability of the nation depends.
I thought perhaps the part that would cause you concern, and certainly has me and a number of our other guests, including Peter Vincent Pry, our friend and colleague, is the faithfulness of the implementation of the executive order. We've, of course, had one on the vulnerability of the grid, specifically to electromagnetic pulse, that the president signed out in March of 2019. And I think there's not been as very much to show for that executive order, hence concern about whether this one will be faithfully discharged as well. Your thoughts on that, Ambassador?
I completely agree with your assessment. I worry, in fact, with the Department of Energy being put in charge of it. On the one hand, that's where a lot of expertise lies. On the other hand, we've had a major transformer that Duke Energy, our partner in what we're doing here in South Carolina, gave one of these humongous transformers for testing at the Savannah River National Laboratory well over a year ago. And it's been sitting idle in Charleston for lack of $1 million from the Department of Energy just to ship it up to the Savannah River Labs and conduct those tests. We've never tested such a transformer. It's not made in this country. It is made in Germany and South Korea, and they're tailor-made for all these key step-down transformers in the grid, and we're totally dependent upon them. We haven't tested it, and it sits idle for lack of $1 million out of the Department of Energy. So if energy is going to be in charge of it, they got to do a lot better job than they've done so far.
We'll be following that story much more closely. I appreciate you calling our attention to it. Ambassador Hank Cooper is our guest, and I did want to reserve the rest of our time. It's not as much as I'd like, but do give us an update, Hank, on what you have been doing with help with Duke Energy and some of those co-ops and the like in York County in South Carolina, your home county. How's it going? And are there insights from what you've been doing that might enable us to make a real difference in the vulnerabilities of the grid across the nation?
I think we've demonstrated, yet to be validated, but demonstrated that it's entirely affordable to protect at least the distribution grid, and I believe I can infer from that the bulk power grid as well, against EMP. And the electromagnetic pulse, many consider, including the EMP commission, to be a cyber threat, perhaps the most dramatic one, which is one of the reasons it's included as in the military doctrine of Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. And that's a serious threat from all of those nations that we are ignoring at our peril. So we should be taking it into account. Here in South Carolina, we've employed the same methodology, actually led by an expert who has done this for military systems, in assessing the hardness or the vulnerability, rather, of the grid in York County, South Carolina, the distribution grid, and estimating the cost of what it would take to harden that grid to the same levels that we protect our Minuteman system and the plane the president flies on and all the rest. And it's like $100 one-time cost for per citizen of York County. We need to validate that and develop the methodology for spreading the word, if you will, around the nation. We're working with the Adjutant General here in South Carolina. He's been here from the very beginning. I believe the National Guard is the way to carry this out. We have responsibilities in the state of South Carolina that link us directly to the commander of NORTHCOM, the commander of Army North down in San Antonio, which is also trying to get funds for an important demonstration activity, as well as First Air Force down in Panama City, Florida. So if we work through the National Guard, and as I said, our Adjutant General's on board with doing this, his Chief of Staff, the Director of Emergency Management, the state of South Carolina, if we do this right, we can demonstrate how to protect the grid in South Carolina, North Carolina, and the rest of the nation. One last thing. I believe that if the President and the Congress undertake a phase four, and there have been suggestions by various representatives that there is a phase four stimulus that would make sense and to protect the critical infrastructure of the nation, they should include the electric grid as a part of this. And if they do that, then the civil engineers are replaced or augmented by electrical engineering, and you could have a lot of jobs that fall out of protecting the grid as well.
And give us just a sense, if you would, Hank, this is such good news, I think, both that the costs are so manageable and that the National Guard is stepping up to this. Can you give us just a little bit more detail on what role the Guard would play?
So if we learn the lessons here and the National Guard across the nation is willing to take on this challenge as a real program, objective, like their civil support teams, which exist in every state in the nation, and just extend that role, train the people to execute it, then we have a vehicle actually already embedded in the responsibilities of the National Guard to carry out this mission.
Well, this is such an important insight and, well, breakthrough, I think. And I salute you, Hank Cooper, for your leadership in this space, as you have been leading for decades in various other capacities. As I mentioned earlier, you're a great American, my friend, and we're proud to have you as a member of our Secure the Grid Coalition team and as a much, much admired and valued colleague. Come back to us again with updates, if you would, sir, very soon, if possible. We're anxious to hear more as to how you're coming. Next up, we'll be speaking with former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles. We'll take stock with him about Iran, threat from that quarter, and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by a former Assistant Secretary of State. His name is Robert Charles. He has been, in addition to a public servant in that role, a very important contributor to our national security over a number of years in a variety of incarnations, starting as a naval officer specializing in intelligence, working in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses as an attorney, and then onwards to help with the present challenge that he's confronting now as a private citizen at the Charles Group. The author of Eagles and Evergreen, a terrific book, and a very frequent active contributor to the public policy debate at places like Fox News and the Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC.us. We're always delighted to have him with us. Robert Charles, good to have you in the house virtually. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Let me just ask you quickly, Bobby, about a couple of things that are, I think, on both of our minds. We are seeing from not only communist China, but from some of its, fellow travelers, a lot of pushback on the arguments now being made by both the president and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo as to the evidence that China and a laboratory connected with their biological weapons program may have been the source of this pandemic. What do you make of what the Chinese are saying, and where do you think the truth lies?
I think what's happening, Frank, is that we're entering on to a very dangerous and probably long-range conflict here with China, and this is sort of revealing. You and I have talked about this before, and I have to give you credit for having been ahead of the curve on this, that the Wuhan Virus Research Center, basically the Viral Institute, appears to have actually been the source of this. And Mike Pompeo has said the evidence is I don't know that he used the word overwhelming, but extraordinary and piling on. And the Chinese, you know, what's happening is this sort of the untruthfulness of a communist regime is coming now to the surface in a very vivid way. We've known they've been untruthful about everything from currency manipulations to how they managed the WTO relationship. First, we're not going to build any islands in the South China Sea. Then they built them, and then they weren't going to be militarized, but actually they were being militarized. And of course, you know, weapons in space and a number of other areas. The economic intrusion on the free world is really extraordinary. But this is bringing to light for people who have never recognized before the intent, the power, and the ability of a communist country to lie outright. And what they've done is they let loose a virus that has killed hundreds of thousands of people globally. And it is something for which they have to be held accountable. You know, I will also credit President Trump because he's taking this seriously, but he's taking it on in the way that I think Reagan would have, which is to be direct, but also incremental. He's said that he's going to hold back funds right now on the WHO, the World Health Organization. He's going to reevaluate certain parts of the trade relationship. He's not talking about, you know, going to battle stations. But in a way, I don't want to say spiritually, but in a way, I think culturally, we need to be suddenly reawakened on this. And I've seen two polls recently that suggest Americans are really recognizing this. There was a recent Pew poll that suggested that 2 out of 3 Americans now for the first time recognize that China is a significant threat. And there was a poll we did with AMAC, AMAC.US. And again, this is older Americans over the age of 50. And they were overwhelmingly, not only were they overwhelmingly now from a national security perspective, suspect of China, but they also thought that Senator Cotton's bill and the idea that you take our dependence off China economically as much as possible was the right way to go.
Let me ask you about one thing, Bobby, because it's top of mind for me. This morning, I saw an article that appeared, I believe, in the Daily Mail in the United Kingdom. Photographs accompanying it showed images that were, until recently, on the website of this Institute of Virology in Wuhan, in which members of the team that was out collecting bats for the purposes of doing research on the coronaviruses that they carry were totally unprotected, or virtually totally unprotected, against the droppings or urine or any other kind of contact with those creatures, both in the field and in what appeared to be inside the laboratory. And it's the fact that all of those images and the other documentation that was once on the website has now disappeared, and presumably the lab itself has been cleaned out, as was the wet market, by the way, all speaks to the point you're making about the deviousness of the regime in China and the unlikelihood that we're actually going to get to the bottom of this anytime soon.
Well, you're right. And I guess I'm going to make 2 points. One is that on this specific issue, which has led to millions of infections and hundreds of thousands of deaths globally, they need to be held accountable. And the point you make about the bats is significant. I just want to go back to some hard facts. The first case that is publicly known occurred on November 17th. It's very clear that the Chinese immediately after that learned that it was transmissible human to human. They destroyed the specimens that proved that. They then enlisted WHO to lie for them. But more importantly than that, the city itself, Wuhan, is a place where people, it's a region of China where they do not consume bats. So the notion that it originated in the wet market is really not credible, that bats were not sold in the wet market and people in that part, that region of China, do not eat bats. That is then corroborating the idea that it must have come from the institute itself. Are these photos, which you're right, they took down, you know, that's evidence of covering up. But there are so many significant, we don't even have time to go through them here, sequence of events that prove that they were covering up in this particular case and that they are directly responsible. It goes to a much larger point, which is one that I think Americans, all really truly every American who is paying attention to this is beginning to see clearly, and that is that we have indulged China throughout the entire Obama-Biden administration. We indulged them, but we indulged them even before that. We've been indulging them for decades. And Donald Trump came long before this virus, came to the table and said, no more indulging China. This is an untruthful, atheistic, dangerous, expansionist, adventurist, communist regime. And they're going to do it economically, and they're going to do it militarily, and they're going to do it with every means they have. They have been on a tear with military modernization, and suddenly, again, I'm not saying with intent that this was released as some kind of biological weapon, but suddenly the recklessness comes to the surface right along with the lying about it. And I think if you lie about one thing that's this big, then you're probably lying about a lot of things. And that's the average American. Yeah, that's what the average American is beginning to pick up.
No, and that's the slight silver lining to all of this, as you say, Bobby, in the polls that you've mentioned and others, including one that the Committee on the Present Danger China, of which we're very proud to have you as a member, did back in January before the pandemic, signaling that there was a lot of sentiment in this direction as well. Let me ask you quickly to turn to another topic. We were just talking with Ambassador Hank Cooper about the threat of electromagnetic pulse attack on our grid and other challenges to it. Also about the executive order that the president has issued recently to re-up his concern about the need to protect the grid. You've called attention to Iran at a time when lots of us are now taking our eye off that particular problem set. Give us just your a sense of what this latest missile launch and placing a satellite in orbit might portend in connection with the threat that it could pose to the United States.
Let me say you've put your finger on something really significant with Iran. This missile launch is significant. The rocket that they used to put a satellite into space has one liquid fuel and two solid fuel stages. And the bottom line is it demonstrates for the first time in 10 years that they have an ability to literally convert what they just launched to being an ICBM. That's very dangerous. It's dangerous for the entire world. And of course, we know that Iran has ambitions to be nuclear and to be able to deliver a long range ICBM payload. And so what this really says to us is we cannot take our eyes off Iran. Iran continues to advance behind the curtain. Their intent is very clear. They're following a path that's very similar to the development of nuclear weapons and missile technology that North Korea used. And, you know, again, I think you've pointed out that it's very easy for us to get distracted by coronavirus and to lose focus and concentration on another national security threat that remains significant. And by the way, EMP remains also significant. And I've always thought that. And we're just going to have to be thoughtful, vigilant, and deter even as we also prepare to defend.
Well, one connective tissue here, according to one of our recent guests, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, is the possibility, and I imagine you've given some thought to this, Bobby Charles, that the Iranians could be seeking to achieve a capability that Peter and Ambassador Jim Woolsey and others have imputed to North Korea, a capability that they and others have imputed to North Korea, namely that the satellite that the Iranians have now successfully put into orbit over the United States periodically, among other places, could in fact be used for an electromagnetic pulse attack if there happens to be a nuclear weapon, particularly a super electromagnetic pulse weapon aboard.
Well, I'll tell you that I'm not a living expert on EMP, but I will also say that that kind of a threat seems to me to be, that's a valid concern, and it ought to be addressed by finding out what that satellite's capable of and also being able to defend against EMP. You know, most people don't even think about it. Of course, most of us don't think about the idea that any missile could arrive on continental United States soil. But it's one thing when you have more or less responsible countries that have their hands on these kinds of weapons and have used them over decades as a matter of deterrence, but also recognizing that rational thinking goes along with having such grave power. And it's another thing altogether when you have a country which has stated its intent to do damage and evil and has terrorized the world consistently.
Well, to say nothing of death to America, which has been their mantra for 40 years. Bobby, we have to leave it at that. I'm sorry to say we are hard out of time. Thank you for visiting with us each week. Stay well, my friend. Keep up the good work at the Charles Group. Next up, we will be speaking with David Goldman. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for what I consider to be one of the high points of the week, our visit with David Goldman Spengler in the Asian Times and the author of How Civilizations Die, a Renaissance man whose contributions to this program are deeply valued. David, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure and privilege, Frank. Thanks for having me.
I want to get your current reading, David, on what China is up to. There seems to be increasing evidence of aggressive and, well, at least bullying behavior in the Western Pacific. Should we read into this that the Chinese are feeling as though the opportunity created by this pandemic may be one they can exploit, and how so?
I think Defense Secretary Esper used his press conference last week to call attention to their most important objective, which is to use the crisis to advance their technological dominance in 5G mobile broadband and the applications that spin off from that. The Chinese are going to claim that their massive surveillance capability, their artificial intelligence, big data, number crunching ability for medical data, gave them a huge advantage in suppressing the epidemic. And they're going to use that as a selling point for their 5G systems around the world. So I think Secretary Esper's warning is very pertinent. The top priority as a second step from mobile broadband that Huawei has talked about for years is becoming the dominant force in healthcare artificial intelligence. Now, that's a huge field. It may be the biggest industry of the 21st century. They want to dominate it. As the I quote in my forthcoming book, You Will Be Assimilated, in an interview from the chief technology officer of Huawei, saying, the control point in the world is the storing and portage and manipulation of data. And if we get all the world's healthcare data, then every company in the world that wants to do research, epidemic control, and so forth will have to come to us. So that's a potential huge step forward for China's power, and it's not so soft because artificial intelligence, as you know, has military applications as well as civilian. So I think Secretary Esper was very right to flag that as a concern, and we should be thinking carefully about how we respond to that.
Yeah, let me ask you, David, on this point. It does seem as though it's at odds with their message that there's nothing to see here, folks, move along, in terms of fears about the Chinese using their control of the 5G networks and data for surveillance purposes, for espionage, for data mining that might be injurious to, you know, privacy considerations and so on. On the one hand, and making this point that they've actually got something that can be instrumental in a weaponized sense against the coronavirus.
There's no question that if you can track infections down to the individual level, you can control the epidemic better. I was talking to a friend in Shenzhen, China, a couple of days ago. He said, we can go out in the street, you have to wear a mask, but when you go into any institution like a restaurant, your picture's taken. Your health history is immediately available. They also take your temperature through remote sensors. You can move around freely because everyone literally is tracked down to individual level. Everyone's tested. Everyone's vital signs are continuously monitored. You're under a microscope like a bug in an ant farm all the time. And that does have a certain efficacy in epidemic control. And what the Chinese will tell the rest of the world, particularly the Europeans who are big customers of Huawei, which do you want? Do you want personal autonomy and privacy, or do you want to survive?
Yeah, I call this communism is a cure for a coronavirus. That's a pretty unappetizing choice, if you ask me. But the point is that you've written a book, You Will Be Assimilated, which I gather is going to be a pretty chilling read in terms of the Chinese fulfilling their ambitions to get us all hooked up to the 5G networks. They do that, in particular in some of the European nations, by trying to tamp down, David Goldman, as you know, the concerns that the U.S. government has been expressing under the Trump administration, that they're opening themselves up to deep penetration by the Chinese. How could it possibly be the case that they say, no, 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 not to worry, on the one hand, and on the other, they're promising that you'll have this kind of control over everybody in your society under a microscope, as you say?
They're hoping that the fear arising from the epidemic pushes people over the edge towards their side. They're doing a lot of other things. For example, Ericsson's biggest single customer now is China Mobile. Their biggest sales are in China, and their biggest production facilities are in China. So Ericsson, which is the most important alternative to Huawei, is being, in effect, bribed by the Chinese to stay in their camp.
Right. David, let me pivot. Speaking of the coronavirus, we've been taking stock with you in recent weeks about both your personal experience and that of Manhattan, in which you live. Tell us kind of how things stand at the moment. And we were discussing off air the contrast between what's going on in Manhattan and elsewhere in New York City, on the one hand, and what has been going on in Hong Kong.
Well, it has been pointed out by the New York Post and a number of conservative writers that Governor Cuomo, supposedly the great white hope of the Democratic Party, is responsible for many thousands of deaths by forcing nursing homes with inadequate personnel and adequate protective gear to take in patients who are already infected with coronavirus. So a very large proportion of the enormous number of deaths in New York City are old people who are dying in nursing homes without proper care because Cuomo forced this to happen. It's one of the great scandals. Hong Kong, by contrast, a city about the size of New York City, where I've been, I lived for some years, has exactly 4 coronavirus deaths and about 1,100 total infected cases, and they've loosened up. Schools still aren't open, but, you know, life is pretty much getting back to normal. That's also true in a number of other places, like South Korea and Taiwan. Also, parts of Germany have done extremely well. So the Democratic leadership in New York City and New York State, de Blasio and Cuomo, have bungled this worse than any other political jurisdiction in the world, with the result that New York City is still in lockdown and there's no end in sight.
So, David, if you were to characterize what it is that has made these other places, whether it's Hong Kong or Japan or South Korea or Germany, so much less afflicted, shall we say, by this, I call it Chinese Communist Party virus, what do you think is the answer?
It's mainly political preparation, having sufficient supplies of protective gear so that healthcare workers become part of the solution instead of people who actually spread the virus because they get infected themselves, giving timely warnings to the population so people can practice the right kind of social distancing and take other appropriate preventative measures. It's a simply good, sensible political organization. That's what we lack in New York, above all.
To the extent that that's the case, is it because they discerned evidence of what was afoot from communist China in ways that the United States did not, or specifically that these democratic leaders in New York State did not?
The Asian countries are next to China. They know a great deal about China. They have good sources in the mainland. So Taiwan was an early warner about this. The Hong Kong government knew about this. So did the Koreans. So they were on top of this very quickly. And they acted very effectively, which is why you've got very low death rates in South Korea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong as a result of that. Singapore a bit higher, but that's mainly because of a lot of migrant workers.
Right. David, just on the Taiwan question, very quickly, the World Health Organization is having a meeting later this month, and there is adamant opposition on the Chinese government's part to the idea of having the Taiwanese participate in it. A large number of countries apparently think, in part because of Taiwan's success in managing the disease, that they should be allowed to participate in it. What do you think is likely to come of that?
I think the likelihood is that Taiwan will not participate because under the standing one China policy, which everyone signed on to, Taiwan is not represented in international organizations. It doesn't have a seat at the UN. It doesn't have a representation at the International Monetary Fund and World Bank and so forth. And all the UN organizations, including the WHO, follow the same precedent. I think this is unfortunate in many ways, but it's also a very big boulder to roll out of the way, which has been there for a very long time.
It's unfortunate, but it also may actually further undermine confidence in the World Health Organization, such as it is. David Goldman, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate your time. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.